This is the My Child Will Thrive podcast, and I'm your host, Tara Hunkin, certified functional nutritional therapy practitioner and mother. I'm here to share with you the latest research, expert advice, parent perspectives, resources, and tools to help you on your path to optimizing the health and development for your child with ADHD, autism, sensory processing disorder, learning disabilities, or other neurodevelopmental disorders. My own experiences with my daughter, combined with as much training as I can get my hands on, research I can dig into, and conferences I can attend, have helped me to develop systems and tools for parents like you who feel overwhelmed trying to help their children. So sit back as I share another great topic to help you on your journey. A quick disclaimer. Please keep in mind that the information provided is for information and educational purposes only. It is not intended to diagnose or treat your child and is not a substitute for working with a qualified practitioner. This episode of the My Child Will Thrive podcast is brought to you by the Autism, ADHD, and Sensory Processing Disorder Summit. You can sign up for free to watch 10 days of expert interviews and masterclasses at www.mychildwillthrive.com/summit. Now on with the show. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the My Child Will Thrive podcast. I'm Tara Hunkin. I have with me again today, Dr. Peter Skyer. We're going to be talking about part two of the series of Unlocking the Mystery of Brain Lateralization. So thanks for coming back again to join us, Dr. Skyer.
Absolutely. It's great to be here today.
So just a quick reminder of who Dr. Skyer is and why he is an expert you should be listening to today is Dr. Peter Skyer is known as a brain doctor, and he's examined and treated thousands of children with neurodevelopmental disorders since establishing his first practice in 2005, combined with his 8 years of running. Actually, it's more than that now, running his brain balance centers. How many years has it been?
It's we've been, I think, operational almost 17 years now. My team
I'm not sure why I have 8 years there. I just realized that. So 17 years of running his brain balance centers. Dr. Skyer has received his chiropractic from Life University in Atlanta and has completed graduate studies in clinical neurology, nutrition, vestibular rehabilitation at the Carrick Institute of Graduate Studies. And he's a board eligible chiropractic neurologist. Dr. Skyer has also done lots of other trainings, which if you listen to the last episode of the podcast, you'll hear all of the work that he's done there. He's also the past president of the International Association for the Functional Neurology and Rehabilitation, and he continues to lecture to healthcare providers, including working as a co-teaching with his mentor, Dr. Robert Melillo, the author of Disconnected Kids, since 2008. He currently practices at his private practice, Skyer Integrative Health, in Noonan, Georgia, where he uses a multimodal approach to neuro rehab combined with functional medicine to treat patients around the world. So thank you, as I said, again, for being here with us today. We wanted to continue the conversation around brain lateralization. We often talk here about neuro rehab and all the aspects of it, but understanding why we need to do that work is so important, and how the brain develops and how things like brain imbalances can impact our children and their symptomology. So today we're going to dive into the right brain and the left brain in terms of the specifics around how they work and how, when they aren't functioning appropriately, that might impact your child's symptoms. So why don't we just dive right in and start to talk a bit about the role of the right brain in terms of when we're looking at what's going on with our kids and their symptoms. What are some symptoms of right brain deficiency, and what is right brain deficiency?
Sure. Well, first, I think the most important thing we have to establish is the idea that what makes the human brain unique is the asymmetrical distribution of functionality of the hemispheres. Okay. It's really important that we establish or break down the fact that there's myths of a right brain and left brain simplicity, because it's very complex. Okay. You know, when we're trying to take these very specific neural networks that are housed between the right and left brain and break it down into a way where, you know, the lay public can understand it. But the reality of it is that there's so many different factors here. But when we talk about the right and left brain, what we're talking about is the distribution of functionality between each side of the brain, and that there are certain functions that the right brain is more superior for. It doesn't mean that the left brain doesn't necessarily maybe contribute to that function, but it's almost like maybe 70, 80% or 90% of that functionality happens in more of one side of the brain versus the other. For example, when we're just talking about language, verbal language is going to happen more in the left side of the brain, where nonverbal communication is going to be more predominantly done by the right side of the brain. Okay, so the right side of the brain being designed for facial recognition, being able to pick up all the subtleties of changes in facial tone relative to just how your eyebrow may move and change what someone might be saying or receiving from a nonverbal language, to looking at just even your pupil response and the dilation and constriction of your pupil as we speak. So the generation of nonverbal communication and then the receiving of nonverbal information is going to be more housed in the right side of the brain, where verbal language is going to come from more of the verbal side of the left brain, okay? The different parts of the left brain that create the ability to generate language, but also receive language. So that's an example of how just in that overall function that we need both functions. And what we're always talking about and always relating to when we say a child has or an adult has a brain imbalance, or really the term is functional disconnection, a functional disconnection syndrome, because what we're looking at, doesn't appear to have pathology, okay? That there is just a functional output difference. And so in a child, let's say with autism, the thing that we're going to see a lot is we're probably going to see that increased verbal function, especially in high functioning autism or children that may have what we used to refer to as an Asperger's type of diagnosis, or even that classical ADHD child that develop very hyperverbal skills early on developmentally at the expense of the nonverbal language that you will see more parents will talk about. They don't make good eye contact, or they're not good at reading social cues or nonverbal language cues, facial recognition.
Let's go into that a little bit more in terms of the right brain. So a lot of parents will say, like you said, so you have the child that's high functioning autism that can be hyperverbal, but then how do you explain the low functioning nonverbal autistic child? So how does that play into that functional disconnection?
It's a great question. And we get that asked a lot, and I believe that Dr. Mull and I have probably a little different perspective on it. Number one, that just because a child is nonverbal doesn't mean that their verbal centers or their language centers of their left brain are not developing. I've actually encountered a lot of children that when given a piece of technology, they can actually communicate. Okay, I remember years ago, probably early part of my career, we had a child that could actually type in five different languages on a computer. Okay. So the question is, do they have certain parts of their right hemisphere that control a lot of the muscle control of actually producing language? Okay. I know Dr. Mull is doing a lot of work right now where he's asking questions of nonverbal adults and about their trying to communicate, and they all want to communicate. They all try to communicate, but is it possibly that the sensory motor system is not developed enough that allows them to generate the motricity of language? Okay. As opposed to the thinking of language. Okay. I think of what I want to say. I potentially might be able to type what I want to say, but the parts of the brain that are not developed that contribute to the generation of language. Okay. And so that's a big thing. And then there is, some elements of where in a certain magnitude of the delay, or there's some more global developmental asymmetry or global delays that are happening in the brain where, both sides of the brain are actually pretty developed or underdeveloped in that instance. Okay. So there is a mechanism there that plays into that, but definitely are when we've seen children where that are nonverbal, non-speaking, that even when you can test them cognitively, that they can actually show where they're actually pretty good with certain letter recognition and number recognition, and do have actually the ability to do some basic math calculations and may be able to actually spell even in the absence of not speaking.
It's very interesting when you look at it that way, in terms of, in particular, like you said, the children that are nonverbal by the fact that they aren't, they're able to read, they're able to write, and they're able to communicate through devices like the rapid prompt or typing ultimately, or other things. So, I mean, obviously that makes sense that it's just about the output from a speech perspective, not actually being able to process that information and actually it's just the output really for them.
Yeah. And I think and we've talked about this before in different podcasts, but one of the areas that I would say is probably a major player in that is the cerebellum. Okay. The cerebellum, there are very specific neural networks that are tied. Because if you think of it in terms of what the cerebellum does, is that the cerebellum initiates motricity. It terminates motricity, but it also makes sure that motricity is smooth. Okay. And what I mean by that is that if I want to move my finger outward, my cerebellum is going to create that ability to initiate that movement. It's also going to control how smooth it is, and then where do I terminate that movement exactly? Okay. So when you look at it from that perspective, and you're looking at the pathways in the motor system, and specifically the ability of the cerebellum to functionally develop. And when you take it one step further and go, okay, what develops the cerebellum is movement. And then where do we see the discrepancies in absences of movement early on developmentally? Whether we step back and look at, the absences that we may see in primitive reflexes, necessarily not going through their normal. Because I think one of the things we've talked about, Atlanta, about the primitive reflexes is the existence of them beyond a certain period of time as a sign of brain immaturity or a lack of brain differentiation or lack of brain asymmetry. But one of the things that we also may not realize is there the lag in the asymmetry, the primitive reflexes developing on time, okay, that you have these primitive reflexes that are there in the development of the baby, the assistance of the baby through the birth canal. And then all of a sudden we have this 0 to 3 month aspect of primitive reflexes, 3 to 6, eventually leading to postural muscle, postural reflexes. But if those primitive reflexes don't go through that normal order of time of development, we don't create the complexity of the motor system. Okay. So by not creating the complexity of the motor system, therefore, we don't create the complexity of the differentiation of certain parts of the brain, i.e. being the cerebellum, okay, cerebellum going through these different zones of functionality that then help us set up the next layer of functionality within the motor system, the basal ganglia, which then is firing to other higher centers of the brain and creating that differentiation. So it's really about, that's ultimately when we're talking about this brain asymmetry, is the lack of differentiation, the lack of functional differences between the hemispheres. So the question becomes, where did the problem start? And the problem probably started in terms of the lack of ideal sensory and motor stimulation that then turns on genes in the brain that then codes for the specialization of the hemispheres.
It is fascinating when you break it down like that and just how everything is so connected. And you can see, the miracle of brain development and how, if you have an interruption in that development process, how we can start to see symptomology that we do in terms of that functional disconnection.
Yeah, exactly. And as I communicate, I always try to give our patients and our families some generalities. And I know generalities are not always exact, but I think in this case, one of the things that's important is that when you look at the brain developmentally, it develops from a bottom-up mechanism, a top-down mechanism. But then also, if you look at the brain anatomically, there is kind of like a zone relationship where there are what we refer to in neurology as midline structures of the central nervous system, more intermediate structures of the central nervous system, and more lateral structures of the central nervous system. And the more lateral structures of the central nervous system is what neuroanatomists or really refer to as the new structures of the brain. And these are the structures that most people would say are what makes us human. Okay, that we, biologically, we share a lot of similarity in relationship or anatomy in the midline and intermediate with animals and even fish for that matter. But what makes us unique is the lateral component of our aspects. Now, where that disruption can happen in lateral relationships, and what is these lateral relationships? These lateral functions are really our executive functions, our higher thinking functions of both our right and left side of our frontal cortex. Okay, and so when we hear in neurology a term called your dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, it's the most lateralized part of or outward part of the brain in terms of that, and so. But those more lateral areas of brain are dependent on midline structures developing appropriately, the intermediate structures developing appropriately, and then driving the expression of these lateral zones. And then one of the other things that we know that's unique about the human brain is that if you think of it, that the brain is growing from a bottom-up relationship, meaning from the muscles through the nerves that didn't come into the spine and then up the spine and then up to the brainstem. And then the brain kind of makes this little hard right turn to where now it comes and goes this way. And now we get our limbic circuitry. We get our motricic circuitry of our basal ganglia and our thalamus. And then we get the cerebral cortex that comes around it. What happens at the cerebral cortex level, and what I mean by that is the lobes of the brain, the occipital lobe, the back portion of the brain, the temporal lobe, the parietal lobe, and then the frontal lobe, is that it grows posterior structures forward. So they're growing from a posterior mechanism going forward, then they're growing out. And what happens is if we have disruption in, again, those midline structures, those intermediate levels, we don't get that development from back to front and then outward. And then that outward expression of development is now becomes more of the differentiation or the specialization of the hemispheres from right to left. And then ultimately we again get this big bridge effect between the two hemispheres of corpus callosum that allow us now to create what we refer to as integration. And that's really what we're ultimately saying when we talk about a brain asymmetry or brain imbalance, is that we don't get the differentiation on one side. We don't get the higher degree of development on one side. And then that leads to the lack of integration that happens between the two hemispheres. You know, and an example of that you would see, let's say in a child developmentally, is let's say the child that's struggling with reading, that they may be good with being a word reader. They may be good with their phonics. They may be good with their grammar rules, but they can't use their right brain that allows them to understand reading comprehension. They don't have the ability to understand main idea or inferencing or drawing conclusions. That would be an example of that asymmetry.
So it's incredibly fascinating once you start to see this connection, as we were saying before, which is why assessing a child is going to be essential to finding out where the work needs to be done, I'm assuming, and from my experience as well, and having that assessment done. So we've talked in the past about primitive reflexes, obviously needing to be assessed, and from that explanation, that's clearly important. How do you assess right brain and left brain functionality to determine what needs to be worked on and how?
Well, since we've talked about the idea that we have to look at it from a bottom up and then top down mechanism, you literally go floor by floor. Okay. So you look at, you know, we know, for example, like obviously the primitive reflexes are housed in different parts of the brainstem. So we're not exactly 100% sure anatomically, but there's a good relationship of where we think they are coming from. So that in itself gives us a relationship there. Okay. we also know off the brainstem comes the cerebellum, and one of the other parts of the brainstem is the vestibular system. So looking at vestibular function, okay, looking at right to left sided vestibular function, because when we're looking at the higher centers of the brain, the cerebral cortexes, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, they're dependent on output from the opposing brainstem and the opposing cerebellum. Okay. So for example, my right cerebellum and my right brainstem is going to have enormous amount of firing to the opposing left hemisphere. Okay. So when you're looking at for brain asymmetry, you want to start out with looking at primitive reflexes. You want to look for dominancy profile, because if a child doesn't develop a dominancy profile, that's also a great example of brain asymmetry. So what I mean by a dominancy profile is relationship of, you know, if I'm right-handed, am I right foot dominant? Am I right eye dominant? Am I right ear dominant? I want my profile to all exist on one side. Oftentimes, many of these kids actually have mixed, you know, profiles, okay? Or they haven't selected a hand dominancy, okay, when it comes to writing. So again, that's an idea that in that early 2 to 3 years of life, those first 36 months of life, that there is a relationship of immaturity. So the primitive reflexes, the lack of dominancy profile, and then are we looking at low muscle tone, hypotonia, and especially are we looking at hypotonia in the larger muscles of the spine, the larger muscles of the trunk, okay, or the muscles, again, of midline postural muscles. If those muscles tend to be weak, those are going to be muscles that are really more controlled by the right side of the brain, as opposed to distal muscles that require more exact movements, okay, very finite movements, are really, you know, under the control of the left hemisphere, okay? So just looking at the difference between gross muscle function versus fine muscle function can be an indication of brain asymmetry. So looking at that, and then just literally working up from the brainstem going to the relationship, is the vestibular system more active or underactive on one side? Okay, typically in a lot of kids, you'll see underactivity of the vestibular system. These are the children that when you put them in a spin chair, or even if you go to the park and you put them on some type of spin device at a park, you can spin them and spin them and spin them and they don't get dizzy. Okay. So there's that hypo vestibular response. In some kids, you may actually have a hyper vestibular response, but the reason for that is that there should be symmetry between the two sides of the vestibular system, to where one side is not overfiring and maybe producing the hyper vestibular functionality, where the other side is hypo firing. Okay. So that's an example where, you know, we may spin a child in one direction and see hypo vestibular function, and then spin them in another direction and see hyper vestibular relationships. Okay. The idea that you may see like sensory system issues, where maybe a child, and you know, depending on the age, maybe you write a number in their hand, you close their eyes and you write a number in their left hand and they can't discern what that number is, but you write the number in their right hand and they can completely discern it. Again, the idea of what we say, you know, parietal awareness, where's your body in space and time? So your parietal lobes allow you to know that. Or if I put something, an object in your hand, and I close your eyes and you can feel it and you can tell the object, okay, then that's in it, but you can't do it in the other hand, okay? Is that a relationship there of some sensory output, okay? Perception of touch, you know, can I touch a child and then tell them with their eyes closed, touch where I touched? Do they perceive one side of the body versus the other? Okay, so that's an example of that. So you literally go through all the difference from a sensory motor assessment. You can go through the differences of right to left side of the brain longitudinally. You're literally working up from the lower parts of the brain, the what I like to say, the floor of the house, the foundation of the house, the cerebellum and the vestibular system and the muscles, okay? Then going into the brainstem and looking at brainstem, primitive reflexes, but all our cranial nerves. We have 12 cranial nerves, that three cranial nerves are involved with eye movements. So we can literally look at the integrity of eye movements and begin to see what the cranial nerves are doing, 3, 4, and 6. Okay. So we can look at basic eye relationships, the ability to converge your eyes towards a target, with divergence at something in the distance, slow eye movements, such as what we call pursuits, being able to slowly track an object. If I ask you to move your eyes from one target to the next, those are saccadic movements. All those eye movements are generated by very specific parts of the brain. Okay. So we can do that bedside. If we have more advanced technology, we can actually look at visual processing and look at the difference between the left side of the brain's visual processing skills for detail versus the right side of the brain's visual processing for global spatial orientation. Okay. You can do that with the auditory system as well. You can do, and so that's how we can really do this from a standpoint of just a bedside diagnostic relationship.
So what happens when you've done all that? And I've been through that. So we've done that more than one occasion with you, with our child. So what happens? You go through all that process, and what would you say typically? So if their child tends to be, there's weaknesses and dominance, right? In terms of sometimes I know that in disconnected kids, Dr. Millo talks about a right brain weakness and a left brain weakness. What happens when there's a bit of both going on? What does that look like, and how do you manage through that?
Well, I think, you know, when we look at maybe a little bit of both sides being weak, that's where we get in more of some of the children that might have more of a global delay, okay? Or it might be in some instances too, where this is, well, in ADHD, you're probably not going to see that. Okay. In a child with ADHD or a child with Tourette's or tics, the children that we would say on the continuum of the brain asymmetry have more, evolved functionalities, you're going to really truly see the brain asymmetry. You're going to see the difference in one side being more dominant functionally and one side being, you know, underdeveloped. Now, when we get into the population of children that would probably be classically diagnosed in the autism community or maybe dealing with persuasive developmental delay, or there are children that are being diagnosed with more of a global developmental delay, then there's a more chance that you may see suppression on both sides, because they didn't get the benefit of the increased lateralization. Okay. They didn't get the benefit of probably the hemisphere traits that are really, because ultimately what drives this brain asymmetry is in our opinion, is the dominant traits that are passed down within the families. Okay. You know, if there's a lot of history of left brain dominant traits, and what are those left brain dominant traits would be like, you know, a family that has a lot of engineers in them, you know, maybe scientists, you know, people that are really good with numbers, okay, or accountants, or, you know, those are going to be the people that are probably going to be more with very left brain dominant traits, okay? And if both mom and dad have those left brain dominant traits, the odds are that they're probably going to pass off these traits. And again, these, and this has been well defined by Simon Baron Cohen's work and Uta Fert's work, that they are really these traits. And that's why it looks like genetics, but it's really not. These are really these epigenetic traits that are being passed down. But in a child that where we see a kind of both and there's kind of a mixture, then they didn't get the bias of those traits. And then you really have to really do even probably a bigger evaluation to say, okay, is this truly more a left brain delay or a right brain delay? And for example, that might be that child that might have persuasive developmental delay symptoms, but they don't have enough symptoms where they can classify them as autism. Okay. That they know that they necessarily have a language delay, but is that language delay really a language delay of the left brain language centers? Because when you actually examine them, they may actually be very gifted with their, or they may show good signs of nonverbal language. Okay. So if a child shows very good signs of nonverbal language and they are not speaking, I'd be more inclined to say that child may have a left hemisphere deficit that's producing the lack of verbal language, because they're showing signs where they make good eye contact. They are good at reacting to nonverbal gestures. Okay. Maybe they have decent motor tone. Okay. But the reverse side of that would be what we started talking about earlier, was a child that doesn't speak, has good left brain verbal skills in terms of, or left brain skills in terms of maths and writing and or maybe, you know, letter recognition. You know, for example, a child that would be probably considered in the autism realm, where they don't have the nonverbal language communication skills. That would be an example of that.
So what are, generally speaking, if you have a right brain weakness versus a left brain weakness, for each of those, what are the typical symptomology and the diagnoses that typically, I know it's not always, you have to, about every kid is different, but typically go with the two different types of deficiency.
So when we get into, like, let's say we'll start out with ADHD. ADHD sometimes can be a little bit confusing because it's important to differentiate between the three types of ADHD and actually the fourth type as well. But so a child that is ADHD, we need to look at, number one, is it just inattentive? Okay. If it's inattentive, they can either go either way. Okay. And the reason for that is that attention networks are distributed between the two hemispheres. There are certain attentional networks on the right. There's certain attentional networks on the left. Okay. Again, the left brain is going to be more biased towards detail attention, okay, focal attention, where the right brain is going to be more, you know, sustained attention or global attention, okay, spatial attention. All right. So when we get into the quote unquote symptom of attention, we need to break it down to that greater degree. I would say that over probably 50% of the children that have been seen in our brain balance centers, you know, nationwide, when they come in with an ADHD diagnosis, it's 50% go to the right hemisphere and 50% go to the left hemisphere when we're dealing with inattention. Okay. Now, if it's more of a type 2 diagnosis of ADHD, and this is where the H component of the hyperactivity or the impulsivity come into it. If we're seeing more impulsiveness or more hyperactive, which are often then seen with some type of motor tic, okay, that there may be an element of a tic or a stim behavior or stereopathy behavior that's seen. You may also see some obsessive or compulsive type of symptomatology, or even some anxiety, types of comorbidities. Okay. And this could be also age dependent. You know, it may originally start out with just more of the impulsivity, hyperactivity when they're younger, but as they get older, you may begin to see more of the continuum begins because the asymmetry actually gets further apart. Okay. Those are more typical of your true right brain hemispheric deficient children. Okay. That they have more of this impulsive, hyperactive. And the reason for that is that there's actually a very specific pathway that comes down from the right side of the brain to modulate a very specific part of the motor centers, motor pathways of the brain called the basal ganglia. And what happens, we don't have this hyper direct pathway that fires down and modulates the basal ganglia. So we get this overactivation in the motor system and the overactivation in the cognitive system. So in the motor system, it's going to come out in the forms of impulsivity, hyperactivity, or some type of compulsion, okay? The compulsion to do something that has a motor action to it, okay? Now, if it's happening in the cognitive realm, then what we're going to see is more obsessions, okay? Or perseverations, meaning that I get stuck on something, okay? I can't change my, you know, tune on the radio. It's like this song in my head, I got it stuck in my head, okay? But then it's also going to come out in the form of an anxiety, okay? It's going to come out in the form of something that bothers me and I'm worrying about it and all that. So again, those are going to be more your typical right hemispheric delayed or right hemispheric deficit children or adults, okay? And then when we get into really the autism spectrum, you know, whether we are diagnosing or undiagnosing Asperger's or what we would also refer to as a nonverbal learning disability, okay, because there is actually a code for that nonverbal learning disability. And then the spectrum of autism is really going to be classic autism is going to be in indication of a right hemispheric delay, Now, when we get into more of the left brain could be that child that is type 1 diagnosed inattention, but their inattention really has to do with their inability to actually pick up details and facts. Okay. So memorization, you know, of factual information from a detail component. Okay. They may be able to get the big idea, but they don't get the details. Okay. And so that could be that type 1 ADHD child that really may have a left brain delay. And my experience is that no one has done enough of a workup to really pick up the fact that they actually have an underlying learning disability. Okay. And it's not been classified as a learning disability yet. They haven't picked up the fact that they have a language disability or a math disability or a written expression disability. Because when you get into learning disabilities, you can, there's multiple categories of them. And so your classic learning disability is really going to be more of your left hemispheric delay. And that's going to come out in the form of probably a reading disability, especially for, you know, vocabulary. If a child has poor vocabulary or poor phonics ability, or they're a poor speller, which for the most part, when you get into especially high functioning autism, it's the complete opposite. I've seen high functioning autism kids in the third grade have the vocabulary that of a 10th grader or a college student, that little professor type of aspect. So that little professor type of presentation is definitely not going to be seen in a left hemisphere deficit. And when you really talk to families and you talk, especially I was doing a kind of a training with a doctor this morning, and we were talking about the difference between his sons. He's got a son that is more this classic right brain presentation, probably borderline, you know, Asperger's / OCD type of anxiety case that we've been working on for about a year now. And now he's starting to learn the Melillo method. And then he's going, okay, well, my younger son is the opposite and has like left brain. So we got talking about it and I asked him, and his son's like in, I think, middle school now, the youngest one. And he's like, yeah, but now that we've talked about it, it's like the fact that he said that, hey, he was a poor speller early on in school and really had to work extra hard to learn his vocabulary words, really struggled with basic phonics rules. Okay. You know, learning phonemes, math operations were really tough for them. That's more that classic left brain deficit. And a lot of times they kind of fly under the radar. And the reason why they fly under the radar is that they typically don't have a lot of behavioral problems. The only time they're probably going to have behavioral problems is when they're asked to do a preferred task or a non-preferred task in academics. Okay. That they're going to try to have these task avoidance tasks. They're going to have good nonverbal ability. They're going to have good social engagement. Their social emotional levels will probably be more appropriate for their age. They're going to probably make friends, establish friendships, maintain friendships pretty easily. They're probably going to have interest more in the arts of creative art or more the aspects of sports. So that's going to be more that left hemispheric delay child.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you get into all those pieces and you can start, and I'm sure parents that are listening are identifying aspects of their children in all those descriptions there. So once the weakness or dominance has been determined, then I think one thing that everybody should understand is then there's a way to rebalance the brain. So can you just give us a high level sort of introduction to how is that done? Like, how do you begin to craft a neuro rehab plan based on the findings that you get from assessment of these children?
Well, it really goes back to this bottom up, top down relationship. Okay. So starting at the bottom of the nervous system, starting out with, if a child has retained primitive reflexes, they're going to be instructed to do reflex integration therapy that's done with more of a laterality aspect to it. Okay. That there are certain reflexes that may give us an indication of laterality. There's a lot of people out there doing a lot of, you know, primitive reflex work, but I'll be honest that the majority of their primitive reflex protocols are not enough to eliminate the primitive reflexes, because the primitive reflexes are also a reflection of the asymmetry in brain. Okay. So if they're superimposed. And so if you're only trying to eliminate primitive reflexes, if you've gone through some primitive reflex training, and there's lots of people out there, and I really say that, you know, with kindness, but at the same time, I think there's a lot of misinformation regarding it. I know Dr. Mole's work has brought a lot of awareness to primitive reflexes, but the problem is that people are just focusing only on primitive reflexes and not realizing that if you don't go up and start stimulating other parts of the brain to improve the higher centers of the brain to come and develop, you won't get the inhibition of the primitive reflexes by solely doing a primitive reflex exercises. If all you're going to do is identify the 18R reflex and all you're going to do is try to do an 18R exercise, and there's all kinds of ways that people are coming up with different novel ways in their mind to eliminate it, but you're not going to eliminate it. I can assure you, I've seen people that have brought their kids and done a year or two or 3 years of primitive reflex training by itself with no emphasis on trying to activate the weaker hemisphere and not eliminate these primitive reflexes. So it's going to come down to doing the primitive reflexes in a hemispheric progression. Also then doing, like, for example, if we determine that a child has weak core muscles, how are we activating those core muscles and stimulating those core muscles? At the same time, we are stimulating the sensorium, the major senses, in a very hemispheric way. Each sensory system has a bias to to each hemisphere. So there are visual relationships that come into the right brain versus the left brain. There are auditory pathways that are going to go towards the right brain versus the left brain. There are smell pathways that are going to lateralize more to the right brain or left brain. Okay, somatosensory movements. If I do somatosensory stimulation on the left side of the body, I'm going to fire more of the right hemisphere and have a consequence on it. So that's the biggest thing, is really sitting there and going, okay, I'm going to do these very specific hemispheric therapies. For example, back to the vestibular system, really saying, okay, if we're going to emphasize stimulating the right side of the brain, we're probably going to concentrate on left vestibular system types of stimulation and left brain stems types of stimulations to stimulate the right hemisphere. So it really comes down to that. It really comes down to doing the stimulation that's very directed towards the weaker hemisphere, and not only doing it in a sensory motor ability, but also doing it in a cognitive level and doing specific type of cognitive-based therapies that will fire the right side of the brain versus the left side of the brain. Also doing academics. If a child presents into one of our brain balance centers or someone doing the Malo method protocols, they need to do some academic, you know, work that's going to fire that right side of the brain.
It's interesting, like, it's fascinating to see how important it is to really identify specifically for your child. I mean, there are lots of resources out there, to Dr. Mello's book being one of them, to help you identify these things at home. But understanding how they all tie together is always the challenge for parents at home. What advice do you give them in terms of, if they can't get to someone that has your level of experience with kids, there's only one of you in one place. And I know there's other practitioners that you and Dr. Mello are training, but what can they do at home with some comfort level to get started if they can't get to a practitioner they can work with right away?
Yeah, if they don't have the ability to be able to get to one of the brain balance centers, or they can't get to a Malo certified practitioner, obviously Dr. Malo and I work with people remotely, and we do quite a bit of that work, and others do that as well. But even if that's not a feasible option, then, you know, for them to really start with the Disconnected Kids book. The book is going to be actually coming out in its third edition at some point this year, which is, for a big publishing company like Penguin, as you know, that's a huge honor. There's only a handful of people that have actually had a third edition of a book ever be done by Penguin. So that's how successful that book is. I actually think that Dr. Mello said they sold more copies than they've ever sold last year, because more and more people are becoming more aware of his work. So the starting point of that is really start with the book. And I tell the parents that the first couple chapters of the book is really getting the concepts of what this idea of brain asymmetry. And I'll be honest, I've never had a family that, and especially our skeptical dads, that come in. And I remember sitting in my brain balance centers for years, and dads would walk into a meeting and their wife had brought the child through the evaluation and everything. And then they'd sit in the report of findings with their arms crossed and everything. And the first thing I'd ask them, I said, did you do your homework? And they're like, yeah, we did the homework. And I said, so you read the one chapter I asked you, because I only asked dads to read about 12 pages in the book. Okay. And I said, but did you read the chapter that was really about the left brain and the right brain? It's like, yes. So what do you think? He said, I got to admit, it made sense. I'm like, all right, good. And so if it makes sense, then we can start the conversation of, all right, what's the problem? Okay. Or what's the degree of the problem in terms of laterality? Okay. So yeah, I tell parents to start with the book, read the first couple chapters of the book. And then when they get to the chapter on the master hemisphere checklist, to literally go down the master checklist, and then they can begin to see how the brain asymmetry is happening from a symptom-based standpoint. And then in another chapter of the book, Dr. Moll literally explains a basic sensory motor exam that parents can do. And I know that we did a little bit of that through one of our master classes, and we're going to get into some how to do that more further this year. But that's a good starting point too, is just to go through the basic relationship of, he talks about the basic primitive reflexes that you can check, talks about how to look at a basic hemispheric postural exam that you can begin to look at that. And then also too, he talks about the cognitive component of the asymmetry and getting into how individual achievement test is a great tool. And so for parents that may have had some academic assessment tools, once you learn the right brain and left brain cognitive dynamics and academic dynamics, you can actually probably go back to a report that you've had. If you've had a psych eval done by a school psychologist or a private practice psychologist, you may have a Wyatt or Woodcock Johnson sitting there, and then you're like, oh, wow, I can actually look at this and see the difference in my child's brain asymmetry. So I think once you actually get the understanding of the brain asymmetry, the sensory exam, the motor exam becomes, I think something that, okay, if my child clearly has low muscle tone and can't do these core stabilization exercises, can't do push-ups, can't do sit-ups, can't hang from a flex-hanging monkey bar, and they struggle with that, then they have nonverbal learning, issues, they have more behavior issues, then this is probably going to be more of that right brain problem. And then Dr. Moll does give some basic right brain types of stimulation. He does a great job, I think, in the book of explaining the neuroanatomy and neurology behind the sensory system. And then you can understand, okay, well, why I might want to do a certain color frequency to stimulate one hemisphere versus the other, or why I might want to use certain music frequencies or to stimulate one hemisphere versus the other, why I may want to use vibration sense only on one side of the body, or do brushing techniques on one side of the body, or only spin. That's the nuances of what we do. And then how do we make it multimodal, or what we refer to as co-activating, where we're layering these modalities on top of each other, which is really different than the traditional occupational therapy arena and the physical therapy arena. They're probably not going to look at it from an asymmetrical level unless they've been trained by us now, which we have more people than ever wanting to get trained from that relationship. They're going to probably also do things in a very singular modality model. They're not going to stack their modalities per se. So that's why I think you don't get the results that you would expect.
Yeah. So we'll definitely put the link to Dr. Moll's book in the show notes for today. We are going to be doing a masterclass together, diving even deeper. I mean, you've given so much information even today, but I'm going to let Dr. Skyer completely take the reins again and teach on the topic of brain lateralization. We're going to be doing that on March 28th. And you can sign up for that at www.mychildwillthrive.com/masterclass. So that way you'll be able to join us live and ask your questions as well after we walk through all this. I want to thank you once again for joining us today on the podcast. I look forward to this next masterclass because I know how much everybody benefited from the last one that we did back last fall and last September. So I can't wait to do that with you at the end of March.
No, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be really exciting, and we're going to really dig deep, because what I ultimately want people to come away with realize this is neuroscience and there, this is not just Dr. Mobile's theory. This is where all the research that's coming out on the brain is all related to brain asymmetry. And so that people can understand this is cutting edge. This is what researchers are saying. And we've just created a clinical model and a learning-based model with the centers and then the clinical model with Dr. Mobile's work for parents to get help.
No, it is very exciting to see all the research sort of coming together now to support what the clinical model that you've been doing. And then obviously you, through the centers, Dr. Mello and the Brain Balance has collected a lot of data over the years as well. So I look forward to hearing more about all those things at the masterclass. And
yeah, the Brain Balance centers have the largest, probably at this point now, probably one of the largest levels of data on, I think from what I last heard, we're at over 50,000 plus students of data. You know, no, I don't think anybody, you know, maybe the only person that comes to mind that may have that kind of data is Dan Amen on his SPECT scans. But other than that, nobody, I think, in the childhood developmental arena, you know, has that kind of data. I mean, even the Harvard study that Harvard just completed, they only had 23 subjects in the study, you know. And so, you know, it's very hard when people, you know, do research to actually find research subjects. And so research is a very small database. So the fact that our centers now can produce the volume of research on years and years and years of kids is only going to show that, you know, what we're doing actually does work.
It's pretty exciting. Thank you again for joining us here today on the podcast. And I look forward to talking to you again really soon at the masterclass. And I hope everyone here will sign up and join us so you can ask your questions live as well. Bye for now. Thanks for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, please support us by subscribing and giving us a review on your podcast platform of choice. This is Tara Hunkin, and I'll catch you on the next episode of the podcast, or over at mychildwillthrive.com, where you can find articles and the free My Child Will Thrive toolkit too. Make sure you don't miss out on the opportunity to join Dr. Skyer and I for his latest complimentary masterclass, where he'll be doing a deep dive into unlocking the mystery of brain lateralization. You can sign up to be notified to join us at www.mychildwillthrive.com/masterclass. See you then.